There's nothing more satisfying than finding the perfect green paint for your living room. Except maybe popping open that can of Valspar Ultra and rolling that first smooth stroke on the wall. And there's nothing more satisfying than admiring your freshly painted wall.
Ooh.
Except maybe peeling off the painter's tape to see those crisp edges. But the most satisfying part of all? Valspar Ultra's price tag, starting at $29.98 a gallon. Affordable, durable, available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Three Down Nation podcast. I'm Justin Dunk, joined by John Hodge and JC Abbott. Fellas, the Canadian university football season kicked off. Was there better games in U Sports than the CFL this weekend?
Well, I think it's a little bit easier for U Sports to have better games because there's just more of them, right? Like, that's part of it. There are 9 games to start this season across 3 conferences. That being said, I mean, you've got a quadruple overtime shocker with Western and Queens. I mean, it's not a shocker that Western won, but that game was a 16-point deficit for the Mustangs to overcome at the 3-minute warning. And then they actually led, like 2 touchdowns, 2 two-point converts, and a field goal. Queens gets the ball. They end up tying it at 29 with a last-second field goal of their own. And then they go to quadruple overtime. Like, there were a lot of great U Sports games this week. We'll talk about those a little bit later in the show. But it is a pity and a crime that this was not televised anywhere. Yes, you could stream it for money. I appreciate that. I'm not saying it was impossible to find. But your average Canadian is not going to pay money to sit and watch a stream on their laptop when the CFL is on TSN. This needed to be on national television, and more people needed to see this game. It sounds incredible.
How do you know if those stats were right, though, Hodge?
We don't, because the U Sports stat system is atrocious right now, and credit to U Sports for having some culpability, putting out a video after they had some challenges on Friday, which was the first day of the U Sports regular season. But I know U Sports went to Genius Sports, the same stats provider that the CFL had a couple years ago. They are now introducing this year a brand new system. So they've gone away from Genius. And at least in the very short term, it is not borne fruit. So we'll see if maybe it does moving forward. I know I was looking through all the play-by-play and stuff, and I found a 4th down in one of the games. I'm like, well, surely this is wrong because there are not 4 downs in Canadian university football. So hopefully, maybe it'll be an arms race. We'll see which gets the stats right first. Is it the CFL? Is it U Sports? Right now, I'm putting my money on the IFL because it seems like someone else will get this right before we get it right. Unfortunately, it's a bit of a mess in the stats game right now.
It's Sunday morning.
That's a real turtle and snail scenario.
Yeah, it is. I see Queens having scored negative 14 points in the 3rd quarter. Is that possible in football?
If you give up 2 pick sixes or something like that, I don't know. Yeah, if you moonwalk into the end zone, I like it. Or you run backwards. Slow motion, I don't know. And look, I would feel bad for being a hater, but like these stats problems have gone on for years. So like at this point, I don't feel the need to sit here and say it in a sensitive political way. If the stats had been perfect up until yesterday and then suddenly they went off the rails, I wouldn't be sitting here bashing anybody. I'd say, oh, well, you know, historically these stats are fantastic. You know, we're all entitled to having a bad day. It's the first week of the season, no problem. But like, this has been a problem for years with the CFL, with U Sports. So we just have to call them out and maybe they'll fix something. I don't know.
Be better. I mean, this is simple. We've talked about it with the CFL time and time again. There are still issues there. And for U Sports, I'll say this much, okay? If the stats were as poor as the players on the field or the effort that the players put on the field, then I would understand people not wanting to watch the product. But since I've been in U Sports, and I know people are counting how many times I reference it, the level of play has continued to go up so far that we have a Canadian university quarterback, Taylor Elgersma, legitimately competing for a 53-man active roster spot with the Green Bay Packers, okay? Coaches and players will tell you now that it is more than a full-time job. It's year-round what these guys are doing at Canadian universities. So U Sports, it's simple. Be just as good as the players on the field. Put in at least as much effort as the players each week. You are doing a disservice to your student athletes. I am sick and tired of the excuses from these institutions across the country. Be better. Match the level of your student athletes, okay? They have risen. You want to raise your fees and make money off their backs and their parents by paying, for example, for the subscription service, but your statistics fall so far behind. Like, it isn't even funny anymore. Be better. That goes for the CFL too. The product on the field has become really entertaining. And we've got multiple quarterbacks this season that are going to throw for over 5,000 yards. But yet, you wouldn't know it sometimes because the stats are not working. And I know Stuart Johnston has said that if they want to be viewed as a professional football league, that they need to fix the stats. Or over half a season in, get it fixed. U Sports, this isn't the first time that you've had a whole bunch of games on a Saturday. That's traditionally when you play games, okay? Just at least be as good as the student athletes on the field. End of rant, but it needs to be said. Like Luke Wilson, I totally agree with what he was saying on Twitter. Pete Diakowski chimed in. If we really, truly want to raise the profile of our student athletes across the country, let's at least get the basics right. To shoot par on the golf course, you got to make your tap-ins. Like U Sports couldn't even make a 3-foot putt right now. Okay?
I have that in common with U Sports.
Get it right. Hodge, I think you could make a 3-foot putt. I put my money on you over U Sports.
It's well said.
When I play with my buddies, sorry to trap JC, our rule is if the putt is shorter than the putter, it's a gimme. And I think that's because we're all afraid we miss them if we didn't. Anyways, continue, JC.
Yeah. It's well said, Dunk. And I think it's worth noting that for those of you listening who might not yet be familiar with the U Sports game, I would argue it's the most bang for your buck in the country, if not in North America, in terms of watching sports, right? You can walk up to your local university and for essentially pocket change, see some of the best player, the best football, the most entertaining football possible right in your own backyard, with players that go on to long, successful professional careers, become stars in the CFL, become stars in the NFL even. That's available to you. It doesn't get pushed. It doesn't get marketed, essentially because of the incompetence of the leadership at U Sports, or traditionally that has been the case. But for fans, if you haven't gone out to your local U Sports team in a couple of years, it's about time you did. Walk up to the stadium, enjoy that experience, pay these athletes the tribute they are due, because you just might see the next star, and I guarantee you're going to be entertained. Because as we said, you know, there's a quadruple overtime game between two powerhouses in Western and Queens right on offer this week, and almost nobody watched it because it wasn't publicly available to the masses. That has to change.
And you can't even see the stats. Like, a lot of people within U Sports are going to listen to this podcast and they're going to get their backs up. They're going to get defensive. But let's flip it around, okay? We at Three Down Nation are not saying that we are perfect. We strive for a high level. People reach out to us when we have made mistakes or typos or don't feel like our opinions were conveyed in a respectful way. And we do our best to not get defensive, but to work to be better. So I don't want to sit here pretending to be on top of the mountain, you know, casting aspersions on everybody below. We try to deliver the best possible product we can. But we have other people, fortunately, in the football community in Canada that help keep us on the straight and narrow. And a lot of times, fellas, balanced. So when we say this, it comes from a place of passion. And to JC's point, there are legitimate stars on these campuses across U Sports. Guys, not even in just football, but in the other sports. Like, we focus so much on football. I get it. That's what we cover day in and day out. at Three Down Nation. But this is what I'm talking about. Like, we have Olympians on these campuses across the country that I don't think get marketed properly, let alone football. But we're talking about guys that are legitimately going straight from U Sports now to being stars in the Canadian Football League. Look at the Philpott brothers. Those are easy ones to single out. Jalen Philpott, Tyson Philpott. You look at the NFL. You have guys that are being selected from U Sports schools in the NFL draft. And sometimes, fellas, it's hard to even come across a decent picture for some of these guys. So from an overall standpoint, like, we just want so badly the product and how it's being marketed to be better and be seen by more people. I can understand the subscription fees and wanting to make money there a little bit. We'll see if the numbers pay off. But Luke Wilson said it on Twitter, like, we need to have U Sports football and some of the other sports on national television. Okay, let's get into the show. Is there anything else you guys want to rant on?
No, I'm good.
Okay, we happy. Let's do it. And discuss an extraordinary performance by Argonauts QB Nick Arbuckle.
Edmonton gaining ground in the CFL's playoff race.
The U Sports football season kicking off.
Brandon Banks officially retiring from professional football and the CFL.
And Micah Awe receiving a max fine for two high hits. But first,
the Saskatchewan Roughriders were shut out in the second half during week 12 against the Calgary Stampeders, dropping the clash of top West Division teams 32-15. Did that game have you commending the Stampeders or burying the Riders?
It had me commending the Stampeders. And I'm not going to bury the Riders just yet. They're still 8-2. And the Riders' season is interesting. You look at it, they went 4-0, lost to Calgary. Had another four-game win streak, lose to Calgary. Fortunately for Saskatchewan, the Riders do not play Calgary, at least for the rest of the regular season. But, you know, I would imagine for them to potentially get to the Grey Cup, they are going to have to beat the Stampeders unless there's an upset along the way. I think this game, fellas, comes down to just simple matchups in one-on-one, which Calgary has dominated in these two games against the Rough Riders. You look at that last sack on Trevor Harris before Corey Mace pulled him out of the football game, and what happened? Justin Sambu simply imposed his will on Logan Ferland, who a lot of people have talked about last year and even this year as potentially being a most outstanding offensive lineman candidate. I'm not saying that he's not. But on that singular play, I think that to me spoke about the overall picture of this football game, because Calgary, again, dominated up front, largely rushing four. You know, earlier in the game, Clarence Hicks turnstiles Peyton Collins for an easy sack on Trevor Harris. Now, I'm not saying this was a regular thing throughout the game, and I'm also not saying that Ferland or Collins didn't win any reps. But those stand out overall to me as, again, the Calgary front four, for the most part, dominated Saskatchewan. The Riders played less than one quarter of football in that second quarter and were able to have a lead going into halftime. But this matchup against Calgary is a problem for the Riders. Yes, there was a late change in the secondary. Marcus Sales was out. That shifted Nelson Lacombo to the boundary cornerback spot, and Jackson Ford stepped in, I thought, rather nicely at safety for the Riders. But there are some matchup problems here for the Riders that need to be addressed if they're going to get by Calgary. And it's interesting because Saskatchewan has been a very physical team this season against largely the rest of the league. They've dominated that physical battle. But against Calgary, you know, for the better part of eight quarters now, the Stamps have owned them from a physicality standpoint.
Yeah, I don't think you can completely let the Riders off the hook here, right? We saw a very similar game happen about a month ago at Mosaic Stadium, albeit a day late. But this was largely the same formula. And frankly, I anticipated the Riders coaching staff to have made some bigger and bolder adjustments. That being said, I do mostly celebrate the Stampeders here. This team is 5-0 against the Stampeder, or against the Saskatchewan Roughriders, Winnipeg Blue Bombers this year. Two teams that were the top in the CFL last year, at least in the West Division, and against everybody else this year are a combined 14-1. Like, that is unbelievable. Like, they are 0-5 against the Stamps, 14-1 against everybody else. So the Stampeders, by the way, four of those five wins, not even close, right? There was the one walk-off win at McMahon that the Stampeders had over Winnipeg, but they dusted the Bombers twice, and they beat, I wouldn't say dusted the Riders twice, but they pretty handily beat the Riders here twice. Neither of those games, single-digit deficits. So I'm here to celebrate the Stampeders more so than bury the Riders. Vernon Adams Jr. has done an unbelievable job of going through those reads, taking what the defense gives him, picking and choosing his spots. Yeah, he had a couple of picks in this game, but I thought his ability to buy time with his legs, move the trajectory, move the pocket, he's been unbelievable. Dedrick Mills has been excellent. That offense, like Calgary started two rookies on offense and two Canadian rookies, right? CFL draft haters are always like, well, these kids don't do anything. It's like, well, we got one with five touchdowns and we got one who's arguably the best center in the CFL right now, who wasn't even a college center, by the way. Christophe Fortin was a college guard at UConn, and he's now arguably the best center in the league. So I think the Stampeders are doing brilliant things on offense. And then defensively, I mean, you mentioned it, Dunk. Like, they are able to get pressure with four more consistently than any team in the CFL, and that makes life so much easier for the guys on the back end there, because if they get their opponent into a passing situation, they can run pretty conservative, you know, eight-man zones or run whatever, double match or whatever you want to call it, all the standard coverages that CFL teams run on the back end. And they could pin their ears back with four, and they clearly sped up Trevor Harris's clock. Trevor Harris held onto the ball at least a little bit longer than we usually see him hold onto it, and he doesn't have the mobility to get away from that pass rush when it breaks through. And everybody talks about flow. Everybody talks about Jalen Hutchings, rightfully so. But I love, Dunk, that you highlighted Justin Sambu, a guy who I think was a sixth-round pick out of Baylor. Mm-hmm. Like, not a top DT in this league, but made an exceptional play, got the sack. Clarence Hicks might, I mean, is he the most underrated player in the league? Like, I think he was coming off an Achilles. I don't think anybody talked about him before the season, including us, including myself. I was like, oh, well, we got to watch for Clarence Hicks being healthy this year. Like, I didn't know a lot about Clarence Hicks. I knew who he was. I didn't think he would be an impactful pass rusher. And obviously, yeah, Hutchings and Flo are picking up some of that extra heat from opposing blockers. But Hicks has been sensational pretty much all season. Like, unbelievably quick coming off the edge, but also has the ability to lower his pad level and blow up blockers with power. So if you have four guys who can get pressure, then I think come playoff time, because it looks inevitable, like the Stampeders are going to end up playing Calgary or play Saskatchewan and or Winnipeg, like at least one of these teams come playoff time, possibly both. You'll have different meetings, right, in those locker rooms or in those coaching meeting rooms on the prairies in Winnipeg and in Saskatchewan. Okay, we have all the regular season game film. We know how this Calgary front destroyed us time and time again. What can we do, right? What can we do? Because the Riders have done a brilliant job of keeping Trevor Harris upright against everybody else. But this is now two games against the Calgary Stampeders where that was not the case. So they've got some homework to do for the playoffs.
It's past time that we stop being surprised when the Calgary Stampeders do this, right? This is who they've been all season. And I think you can make a compelling argument that if Vernon Adams Jr. hadn't been hurt, that this would be a, what is it, 8-1 football team now? 7-1? How many wins they got? I don't have the record in front of me.
Seven and one
football. So, no, they'd be a 9-1 football team because they had the one loss with VA. Like, that's who they are. Without VA under center, they were a different team. They couldn't get it done offensively, but they're able to hit the big plays when they need it. They've got great blocking up front by that offensive line, both in the run and the pass game. I thought their play calling in this game was unique and innovative at times. I like how they're getting different guys involved carrying the football. Jalen Philpott got three carries in this game in addition to what he was doing as a receiver. I think that's a really unique way to use a weapon and get him involved in the offense. And then defensively, that defensive line, as much as we've lauded the Riders for their pass rush and what they did a week ago with six sacks, I don't think anyone can touch what the Stampeders is able to do or are able to do with four. And they've clearly outclassed the Riders front on two occasions now. We got a ton of comments, guys, throughout the week from people asking us what we were smoking because we all picked the Stamps to beat the Riders. I had people telling me that it was going to be the Riders by a lot. Well, clearly, whatever it was we were smoking, it wasn't that BC Bud, was prophetic. We were smoking the truth, right? Because this is who the Stampeders have been. They've shown that they are the kryptonite for the Riders. And if Saskatchewan wants to get to a Grey Cup and win it, they have to figure out how to beat Calgary. That has to be their top priority for the second half of the season.
It might have to be, okay? Because let's look at the standings. That win by Calgary was very key for a major reason, the tiebreaker. So if Calgary and Saskatchewan are simply tied in the standings at the end of the year, the Stampeders win first place, earn the right to host the West Final. But if the Riders can do as they've done the rest of the season and beat up on the rest of the league, stay in front for that West Final, then you're going to have likely, I'll say, the Stamps at home against Winnipeg, it looks like right now, or potentially BC. So the Riders could hope for an upset. So I don't want to put it down like it's going
to
happen.
You still got to learn to beat them.
Yes.
Like, well, they've proven.
Play them again is what I'm saying.
Yeah, you might get lucky, but they're still coming for you. And it doesn't seem to matter whether it's at McMahon or Mosaic. They've beaten them at both locations, and they've beaten them badly. So you can't rely on home field advantage to save you here. Rider Nation's screaming masses are not going to be your salvation. The Stamps are coming. You got to be prepared.
I'm just saying, after two games, it looks like the best way for the Riders to beat the Stamps is just to hopefully avoid them completely. Okay, I'm not saying that they can't beat them, and that seems like the likely West Final matchup at the moment. But, hey, the Riders got the Labor Day Classic and then the Banjo Bowl with the Blue Bombers coming up. Those two teams have not played this season. We'll see how they match up in their 2025 versions. But the West Division standings just got real tight, especially at the top. If the Riders were able to win that game, it's a completely different conversation. Then I think, you know, after a couple more wins, we're talking about, okay, how are the Riders going to rest players and get ready to host the West Final? But that Calgary victory is absolutely massive for them potentially hosting the West Final at McMahon Stadium. We'll see how it shakes out down the stretch.
Three quick observations. One is I need a J.C. Abbott hip-hop album entitled Smoking the Truth. That's number one. I need that in my ears. Secondly, can we please stop when teams are really good asking, will they even lose again this year? Like, I think that was a topic on this show like a week ago. It's like, well, the Riders are 8-1. Are they even going to lose again? It's like, obviously they will. This is professional football and winning games is super hard.
Bro, who put the rundown together for the show?
It wasn't me who raised that issue. I will say that because it's a silly talking point. And I also don't think we're the only ones who ran with it. Like, I'm sorry, being 8-1 does not mean you're going to go 17-1. Like, that is, I don't even think it's possible. I think the maximum for wins in the CFL is 16. I think the floor for losses is 2. It is too hard to win games consistently at the professional level to finish better or worse than that.
Wait, wasn't there a one-win team one time?
Yes, that was pre-salary cap. That was, I think, the 2003 Hamilton Tiger Cats. And yeah, that team stunk. I'm not going to defend that. But that was pre-salary cap. So I think in the modern CFL, the floor is 2. It did. And I mean, there have been NFL teams who have gone 0-16. I don't think 0-17. But I think it's twice happened that it's been winless in the NFL. But that's a 32-team league, so it's a bit of a different beast. These teams all know each other. They play each other multiple times a year. I think you're not going to see a sub-2-win team again. And then my third thing is I really, really wish that I could go back to the beginning of the season and bet money for the Calgary Stampeders to sweep Saskatchewan, Winnipeg, but get swept by Ottawa. Because I'm pretty sure laying out like $100 on that, I could retire right now. Like nobody in a million years would have thought, oh yeah, that's what's going to happen. So that's one of the reasons why we love this game and this league is at the end of the day, you can make really, really smart assessments. You can watch all the film in the world. You can talk to all the experts you want to talk to. But sometimes what happens is just almost unimaginable. And that to me is what's happened here with the Calgary Stampeders. Credit to them for 5 big wins against 2 tough West Division teams. The fact that they've lost to Ottawa twice, however, is kind of mind-boggling.
That makes me think, if you're the Riders, you're hoping for Ottawa to go on a run, get that crossover in the West Division, and play the Stampeders in the West Division semifinal. Nothing would be more CFL. Chess.
Now it sounds like Justin's been smoking that BC bud.
Well, I'm just having a little fun. He's got a good point. In my life, when I ever have a problem that I can't get past, I always find that avoiding it and just running away is always the best strategy, right? That's how
somebody else take care of it.
That's awesome.
We should give Calgary some credit. I don't want to be sounding like I'm making excuses for the Riders because they've got their butt whooped twice by Calgary. That needs to change. And Trevor Harris's record against the Calgary Stampeders fellas is worse than like really bad. Like it is not good. I believe, if memory serves, that he was 2-12-1 going into that game against Calgary. I can see my guy John trying to bring it up right here. So I think now he might be like 2-13-1 or 3-13-1, I think is that number. So those are different iterations of the Calgary teams. You know, a lot of those Calgary teams were led by Bo Levi Mitchell when Calgary was the class of the league. But for whatever reason, Calgary has not been kind to Trevor Harris throughout his career. Hodge, did you find it yet?
No, I was looking up Theo Benedet's latest buzz with the Chicago Bears.
I was also looking up Theo Benedet's latest buzz with the Chicago Bears. Wow, great minds think alike, Hodge. We're right.
We'll and to ours that. Do too, apparently.
All right, let's keep it moving. Edmonton, the fifth place team in the West Division, now has a better record than the bottom two teams in the East Division after beating the Ottawa Redblacks. Would you like to see the CFL alter its playoff format to prevent the future possibility of fifth place teams missing out on the playoffs if divisions are uneven? I think we should make it a different way. Teams with better records in the West or the East missing out on the playoffs than teams who have worse records in either division.
I don't understand what you just said, but I think I understand what the question was. So I'm gonna lay it out this way. And the reason I wanted to talk about this, guys, is because somebody pointed this out to me. So the Edmonton Elks are 4-6. They're fifth place right now in the West Division, a spot where obviously right now it's impossible to make the playoffs. Okay. 4-6. Well, the Montreal Alouettes, who are second in the East Division, are 2 points up on Edmonton, essentially a half game up because they, of course, have a game in hand, which means that the Elks are 2 points out of second place in the East Division. Now, they can't actually get to second place in the East Division with the crossover rule, but bear with me. Third place in the East Division is actually Toronto at 3-8, but for all intents and purposes, with the crossover rule, it's the BC Lions, who are 5-6. BC has the tiebreaker against Edmonton, which means it's really like 3 points. So in a way, one can argue that Edmonton is further away from being third in the East than they are from being second in the East. Like they are closer to second in the East than third in the East because BC is that much better. So it's wild. It's wild that the Edmonton Elks are in this conundrum. They, and I've been a proponent for this for a long time. This is not just a, woe is the Edmonton Elks. So this is my opinion now. For years, I have thought that the CFL should just go to one division. I do think that divisional games are nice, right? Every team plays 18. If you play every team twice, that gets you to 16 games. There's two extras. I think that those two should be rivalry / division games, right? Like I think Winnipeg and Saskatchewan should play each other 3 times every year. Calgary and Edmonton 3 times every year. You know, Ottawa, Montreal 3 times. Toronto, Hamilton 3 times, etc. Whatever. But at the end of the day, I think the playoff race would be more compelling if it was just a 9-team league and the top 6 teams made it. Like right now, Saskatchewan at 8 wins, Calgary at 7 wins. Those should be your 2 bye week teams. And I think Hamilton should have to host at 6-4 somebody in the first round of the playoffs. Right now, the Ticats with a game in hand on everybody else in the division are 2 points up. Like there's not a lot of pressure on them to keep playing well. They're just kind of like, oh yeah, well, If we keep jogging our way to the finish line, we're going to get a first round bye. To me, that's not interesting. I want them to fight with Calgary. I want them to fight with Saskatchewan and scratch and claw for that home bye to start. And then you look at a six win team like Winnipeg. Like, yeah, there's kind of a compelling conversation in the West right now with Saskatchewan and Calgary being the top two teams. Like, can Winnipeg get back into the top two? Can they even win the West, right? Host that West final for a fifth straight season? I get it. But to me, this is a more compelling conversation if right now they're in a position to even host a playoff game, because they're the fourth team in the CFL. I think they should get to host round one and have a lower ranked team come in. Like, to me, the playoff races would always be, with few exceptions, I suppose, but almost always be more compelling if the teams were simply placed from 1 to 9. And aside from that, yeah, you'd lose a little bit of maybe the history with some of the rivalries, but like, is anybody not watching? Like, again, keep my example in mind here. So let's say Hamilton gets the third seed, Winnipeg gets the fourth seed. So that would mean Winnipeg theoretically hosts BC in one of the semifinals and Hamilton hosts Montreal in the other semifinal. Okay, well, those are both divisional games anyway. Let's say the two home teams win. So now Hamilton would go to Saskatchewan for one final and Winnipeg would go to Calgary for the other. So one of them is divisional anyway. And a non-divisional national semifinal would be Hamilton at Saskatchewan. Is anybody not watching that game? Because it's like, oh, it's not East-East. I'm not interested anymore. No! Everybody wants to see Bo Levi Mitchell go into Regina, right? That would be a sensational football game. So I don't think we need divisional games in the playoffs, is my point, for these games to be interesting. I think you just need the best teams. And in the modern era of sports where everybody's watching every game, right? If you go back 50 years ago, if you were a fan in the West, you might not even know who the teams in the East were because they were never on television. You didn't know who those players were. It was, you know, if you came to the one game a year where that team was in town, you might see them live. But other than that, you don't know a lot about them. These days, everybody knows every team. They know all the players. They can watch all the highlights. They can read all the stats when they're correct, at least. And it's a good opportunity, I think, to modernize the league, go to one division. You're going to have more interesting races. And I think that you would have more parity because right now Edmonton is further from the playoffs than Toronto and Ottawa, even though Toronto and Ottawa have worse records.
I go back and forth on this, Hodge, because I get your point and I see the argument here. And that's one that's been made about the CFL for a long time. We've seen these situations play out before. And because the divisions are unequal and not just in their sizes, but typically in their performance level, as we've seen the last number of years, it's going to keep coming up. And I understand wanting to see the six best teams in the playoffs, but I still cling to some of that regionality. I think you are playing with a little bit of fire if you are setting up a scenario, and we've seen the East Division struggle for the last decade, certainly for as long as I've been covering the league closely. They have been more often than not the weaker of the two divisions. If you're setting up a scenario where it's going to be consistently harder for Eastern Division teams to make the Grey Cup, I think eventually you are going to see ramifications of that in places where, let's be frank, the CFL has struggled with attendance at times. Montreal is on the come up. But for a lot of years, they struggled. Toronto, we all know the issues there. We know the issues that are happening right now with Ottawa, which has been strong. But since they have not had a lot of success lately, we've seen attendance wane in those locations. I think if you artificially take away competitiveness and playoff races from those teams, or not artificially, because it would be earned one way or the other, you are going to see that affected eventually, maybe not in year one, but in year two or three or four or five at the gate, because people are going to be less engaged down the season if the East is significantly weaker than the West, and they're going to be less engaged when it comes time for the Grey Cup, which still remains a premier television event in this country, in part because it has always been a West versus East showdown. And when it comes time for that game, we've seen teams out East that have been significantly worse in the regular season win consistently on those occasions and pull off upsets, because anybody can win on any given game. I just don't think you want to upset that balance in order to save the worst team in the West, right? To me, the value is not there in that equation, and I would keep the setup as it is.
Hold on. You're not saving the worst team in the West. You're rewarding the worst team in the West for actually having a good record. Like, let's look at it from this perspective, okay?
Good record in brackets. Like, they're below 500.
Doesn't matter. They're still better than the two bottom feeders in the East. Okay, yeah, so you could have a 500 or winning record.
One bottom feeder
in the West
is the same as another bottom feeder.
It's different, dude. Like, if you have a better record in every other sport, and yes, there are more teams like in the NFL and the NFC and the AFC, then you make the playoffs. Like, you deserve to be in, okay? You could have a 500 or winning record in the West Division as a head coach and a GM and get fired. Like, that's happened. Instead of giving out participation playoff spots for the East Division teams, let's raise the bar. Be more competitive. You win, fans come out, okay? And not every Grey Cup, JC, has been East-West. 2007, Saskatchewan, Winnipeg. I know the divisions were different.
Winnipeg was in the East at that point.
I know they were different, but technically, that ain't East-West, okay? Not every Grey Cup has been East-West. You want to raise the level of the CFL, the interest, the intrigue down the stretch. I don't know if Hodges' scenario is necessarily the best one going forward, because I think we'd have to think about it. Okay, how do you rename the playoff games? Because right now it's the West semifinal, even though there could be an East crossover, or it's the East semifinal, even if there's a West crossover team in there. Then you have the East final, the West final. So I think we'd have to figure out how to rename those teams. But I believe the best teams should be rewarded with playoff football. Otherwise, then what are we doing? Like, it doesn't necessarily matter how well you play during the regular season. It more matters how bad are the other teams in your division. And I get that there's been these one-off games where East Division teams have upset much stronger West Division teams in the Grey Cup. But, like, is that what we really want? Does Edmonton deserve to be in the playoffs? Yes or no, JC?
No. They're fifth
in
the West.
Why not? They're in a playoff position if we went to one division. Like, they're better.
They're not, to be clear. They're not.
They're not, for the record. They're still behind Montreal.
They're close. They're close, but they are seventh of nine right now.
My bad. Okay, sorry. I had them with one more win. But, like, they deserve to at least be in the playoff mix behind Toronto, who's been mostly putrid, in Ottawa, who can't get their ish together. Like, I think it would be more intriguing. I don't care about the East-West stuff. Hodges' example, Bo Levi Mitchell going into Mosaic Stadium. That game was the first Riders sellout in 2025. It was hyped up. I don't think that matters. Like, we got to be able to be progressive here with what we're doing in the CFL.
And I'll push back at what JC said, which is like, well, if these teams don't get to the playoffs consistently, they're going to stop showing up. It's like, okay, well, first of all, earn your damn playoff games. And secondly, which team has won two of the last three Grey Cups again? Oh, yeah, that would be the Toronto Argonauts. And which team is still last in attendance? Oh, right, it's the Toronto Argonauts. Like, how many Grey Cups you got to give them? You got to give them two, three, four, six. Stop me when I get to the number. Seven, eight, nine. Okay, we're still going. 10, 11. Like, how many Grey Cups in a year do we have to give them? But until, and I'm not, and by the way, I say give them. The Argonauts earned those two Grey Cups fair and square. I'm not taking that away from them. But what I am saying is, if two of three Grey Cups in the last 3 years still means worst attendance, then that is a tenuous at best example, I think, as a way for these to stay the same. Just earn your playoff berths. And as for the names of the games, I mean, I don't think they really need to change. Whatever westernmost team is available in the playoffs, they're the West final, the other is the East final. Is that a little bit silly? Yeah, but the Bombers have hosted East finals before, and the BC Lions have played in East semifinals before. Like, dumb things have already happened, and it's only a matter of time, by the way, before a West team crossing over to the East wins the East anyway. If James Wilder Jr. doesn't make an insane catch on third down, I think it was 2016, then the Riders would have gone to the Grey Cup as the East Division team already once before. So Like right now, it's looking like the Lions are going to be the third seed in the East anyway. There is nothing remotely East about Vancouver. Vancouver is so far West. It's almost East again, I guess. But it's like the point is, this doesn't make sense to me. It never has. I think arbitrarily having three East teams is silly. And then trying to compensate by occasionally sticking a random West Division team in there makes it silly again. Like, just have the six best teams play. And if you don't want the divisions in there, whatever, that's fine. Well, then you can pick two legends. Like, this is the Russ Jackson Bowl, and this is the Doug Flutie Bowl, right? Like pick your players, pick your innovators, pick your builders. I'm sure people would be very happy with that. Like I think 1-6 is always going to be better than the arbitrary 1-2-3, 1-2-3 in a 9-team league.
Hodge, you were thinking of the 2017 East Final.
17, by the way. Okay, 17, fair.
I just think you're always going to have some version of this debate between who is the least worst of the worst teams.
Not in a one-division format.
Yeah, you because
are better than the other teams you make the playoffs.
Are you telling me 5 and 6 really deserve to be playoff teams right now? Like, yes! looking at the
5 and 6 seeds have won the Grey Cup, bro. Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, but
JC, what if you were a head coach or general manager that was consistently in the West watching, for example, like Marcel Desjardins have 500 or sub 500 records consistently going to the Grey Cup? Bro, you would be pissed. Don't laugh. If you were a head coach or on a coaching staff,
who's in front of me?
GM or football operations, you would be pissed. Your team is like 2, 3, 4, 5 wins better, and you can't get a sniff at the playoffs because we have this archaic setup. It doesn't make sense, bro. JC, come on. Be better, man. Isn't this how you would talk to your football team that you coach? Earn your playoff spot. Don't give out
participation. You earn your playoff spot based on the structure.
Based on the structure of your division. And if it's trash, then you can make it with a less than sub 500 record.
I also think, I think it makes sense to have six teams make the playoffs. I don't think shrinking the playoff pool is a smart decision. The bigger issue is there are years where the fifth best team in the CFL is the second best team in the East, and therefore they get a home playoff game, they get the revenue that goes along with that, and they get the home field advantage that goes along with that. If you just have the six best teams make the playoffs, then the 5 seed goes on the road, and that's a lot tougher to do in the playoffs than it is to do, right? Especially when the weather turns, right? A random, week 4 game, it's a lot easier to go and win on the road than in the playoffs when everything's hyped up, you're probably getting a bigger crowd, the weather could potentially be a factor, all those things. So to me, it's not even necessarily about getting the right 6 teams. Like, that's part of it. But the other part of it is getting them in the right order, right? Because it's very seldom that the 4 home playoff teams, we'll call them, are the 4 best teams in the league. Like we have had years where it's like, okay, well, this team is number 4 in the West. They're the crossover team, and they have to go visit a team that's 3 wins worse than them or 4 wins worse. So then if they make it to the East Final, now they're playing a team with the same record as them. Like, that doesn't make sense to me. You should earn your home playoff game. You should earn your spot.
JC, what's even your point here that makes some sense?
Well, my point is, like, we are arguing about teams at this stage that I don't think, yes, one might have one more win than the others, but like, the resumes are comparable, and they're teams that have not earned the right to be considered contenders yet, right? When we're talking about top 1-6 right now, the bottom 2 teams in that scenario currently are the BC Lions and the Montreal Alouettes. Those are sub 500 football teams. That's what we're arguing about right now.
Yeah, so you're arguing that sub 500 football teams deserve to host playoff games.
No, I'm saying if we're going to change the playoff format, let's get rid of those bottom 2 teams. Like, that's the only way that, to me, the playoff format can be improved.
So you want to have 4 teams make the playoffs?
If we're going to change it, I'm fine with it as it is right now, but I don't think by shuffling it around and getting the team that is the 6th best instead of the 7th best.
What is your point here?
Makes it better.
You want to go down to 4 teams in the playoffs?
No, what I'm saying is I would prefer that to a shuffling around that ensures that the sixth best team is in the playoffs rather than the seventh best team. I honestly, that to me, I don't find that compelling. And I think that there are potential ramifications that even in this more globalized, more nationalized era could have effects in terms of both the popularity of some of these weaker teams.
Okay, so to Hodge's point then, the Toronto Argonauts have won two of the last three Grey Cups. How has that helped them get more fans out? Well, this plays right into your point. Explain.
I think it hasn't this year because they've been terrible. But in between the two Grey Cups, when they were posting the best record in the East, right? They had an uptick.
Yes,
in fan attendance.
Best record.
Yeah, but that was coming off a Grey Cup success.
Best record
where they were an underdog.
It's simple.
Like that,
you
it
win.
Happened at the start.
Fans show up for the most part. The Argos being in the playoffs or not, or winning the Grey Cup or not, has not really tangibly, in a big way, increased their attendance.
Okay.
So that argument, so, I'm not buying at all.
So
you struck
in that
out
argument,
there.
That,
you're striking
fine.
Out by saying that you want to go down to four teams in the playoffs.
Why do we have the semifinals then? So if your argument is that getting into the playoffs doesn't matter for attendance and for team popularity, okay, I'll accept that. Then
I'm
why do we have six
Argos
teams in the playoffs at all?
I'm saying for the Argos, it has not mattered.
Okay.
I have heard
part of this discussion that we haven't touched on yet is the games down the stretch that do not matter because we have the East-West archaic setup. There have been multiple games down the stretch that could have had playoff implications in recent years.
Yeah, but you're going to get that same situation.
If we had one division, you possibly would. But
like,
I think it's more competitive overall.
That. You're
it's more competitive and more fair.
Because if all five teams in the West are in playoff contention, and you've got two bad teams in the East, like we do currently, hypothetically in this scenario, like they'll still be in the hunt longer under the current format when they could prevent a crossover and snag that last playoff spot than they would be if they are in eighth and ninth place and have to jump over an entire other team to get into the conversation. So I don't think you're going to get more compelling matchups or more games that
you
matter.
You have better matchups at the top.
Yes, because right now Hamilton has nothing to fight against except for, well, Montreal's way behind us and we just kind of have to hit them with a stick if they get close to us and then we win first. I want to see a CFL where Hamilton has to battle against Calgary and Saskatchewan, whether it's directly or indirectly in the standings, to be the number one seed in the CFL. Now, I will say to JC's point, I think a four-team playoff is interesting. The downside is you're going to have teams checking out early because once you hit eighth, ninth, you're not really going to have a hope of finishing top four. But I have heard a solution where, well, maybe one and four play a two-game series. So instead of a semi and then a final, you do a two-game, like home and home, where maybe the four seed hosts the first one and the one seed hosts the second one, and a combined score, go old school, that combined score two-game series, winner advances to the Grey Cup. You can call again. One of them can be the Jackson Bowl. Another can be the Calvillo Bowl or whatever you want to throw at it. And then the winners go to the Grey Cup. I think that will be very interesting. But I do think that only having four playoff teams would potentially hurt the entertainment value late in the season when you've got bottom teams trying to fight their way in. I also think that provides maybe it doesn't make it harder on the top teams. I was thinking, the top team, theoretically, it is a one-off right now. If you have a bad game, you can lose your East final, your West final. If you have a home and home, maybe that lowers that a little bit, but obviously you can still stub your toe in one of those games. And you also theoretically be going on the road for one of those games. You don't get the home field advantage that comes along with being the true top seed. So I don't think there's a perfect solution, but I think JC's point seems to be, well, it wouldn't be perfect if we changed it. So let's don't change it. I think we should look at changing it to try to improve it.
I don't know
Nothing
that it's going to
be perfect.
That's my point. I don't know that. I'm certain it won't be perfect. I'm not arguing that this system is perfect. I just don't know that it would be better. And frankly, I just am not particularly sympathetic to the plight of a sixth place team that unfortunately misses the playoffs because of the divisional format. Like, you're in sixth place. Like, cry about it. I win more games. Like, if you want to win
if
under
you're
the current
in sixth
format,
place, you make the playoffs.
In your format, I'm saying, like, if you're in sixth place in the entire league, you might miss out currently because the seventh best team is higher in their respective division.
Okay,
to
but
me,
you're
I don't
okay
find that to be compelling.
With the seventh place team's argument to be in the playoffs over six who has actually earned it on the field.
I don't think they necessarily, like, the BC Lions just lost to the Toronto Argonauts. At that point, like, you are picking shortest straws. I don't find it particularly compelling one way or another. And I don't have a lot of sympathy for those teams. Like, whoever gets the draw gets the draw. You can pick it out of a hat.
But
like,
what I'm saying is you have sympathy for the seventh place team over the sixth place team that's actually earned it on the field.
I don't have sympathy for them. I don't. I'm just saying I think there are valid benefits to having divisions. I think it keeps more of the country engaged for longer. And I'm not going to sacrifice that in exchange for helping a sixth place football team. I don't think that has enough benefits. For me, personally, I'm not going to cry about
make it make sense, bro. That doesn't make sense to me. You're saying you don't care for six in a one division, but you care for seven. I don't get it.
I don't care about them either. My point is, I think they are interchangeable. They both have poor resumes, and I really don't care which one of them makes the playoffs. They probably haven't earned the right to be there and be considered contenders.
Justin and I are of the opinion that it's worth changing history to get the sixth team and the seeding right. JC's opinion is that it's not worth changing history to get the seeding and the sixth place team right. I think
we're not even
both
talking
explained
about the
our
sixth
arguments.
Team. We're talking about like the seeding and actually earning.
That's, I said
where
that
you're
the
at.
Seeding and the sixth place team. You and I are of the opinion that it's worth changing history to get the sixth seed and the seeding correctly. JC is of the opinion that that is not worth it because he doesn't really care who the sixth team is, and he likes the history. And
okay,
I disagree with
I would love
with him,
to hear
but I get the
JC's
point.
Opinion if he was the hypothetical general manager
we're moving
of the
on.
Seventh place
we
team and his
on.
Butt gets fired.
We are
my
moving
opinion
on. Though
he has
would
a
be,
better
be a
record
better
by two, three, or four wins.
Talking about, we
if
are
you have a
rails.
Better record by two, three, or four, if you have a winning record, you get fired, bro, while you're
can
watching
somebody
an
please
East Division team with the less disqualified record.
A cucumber covered in quinoa and just
a Doug's
mouth.
With in that scenario. Like,
boys,
if that's the scenario,
gentlemen,
my job is to win more games.
We're done. Following an extremely impressive 430-yard, four total touchdown performance. You guys are badly behaved today. Nick Arbuckle is now on pace for almost 5,700
yes,
passing
be
yards.
And listen.
Oh, dude, you're not gonna apologize while interrupting me. That is not going to happen. That conversation's done. It's over. You guys can take it off air if you want to. That's fine. For context, Chad Kelly threw for 4,100 yards and 23 touchdowns when he won MOP in 2023. Thus, the question is, should Arbuckle receive serious MOP consideration this year?
My gut says no, just based on what I've seen. But we had a similar conversation last year.
You're not giving out MOP participation awards, JC?
Love espresso, drip coffee, and cold brew? With the Ninja Luxe Cafe, if you can crave it, you can brew it. Espresso? Balanced. Drip coffee? Rich. Cold brew? In a flash. With Barista Assist technology, you brew with no stress and no guesswork. And make perfect silky microfoam hands-free from dairy or plant-based milks. Bring the coffee house home and unlock your favorites with the Ninja Luxe Cafe.
Let the man talk.
We had a similar conversation last year with the Hamilton Tiger Cats and Bo Levi Mitchell when a guy put up remarkable stats for a team that was not particularly strong and ultimately missed the playoffs. And the Toronto Argonauts are not a good football team right now. But Nick Arbuckle has done some remarkable things over the last couple of weeks in some very tough circumstances. He threw for 430 yards in this game without DeMonte Coxey, which is a feat in and of itself. That is not a big name Toronto receiving core. He was getting it done with Dejon Brissett and with Jake Herslow. I think that is a real testament to him. I think it's a testament that he is putting up these numbers despite the fact that they have had consistently poor protection from that offensive line, right? That needs to be taken into account. So I am not ready to outright dismiss Nick Arbuckle. If he keeps playing like this, I think he deserves to be in the conversation. Am I going to necessarily vote for him in the award or give it to him over some of the other compelling QBs around the league who will likely surpass 5,000 yards or get close to it for better football teams and have done perhaps more to elevate the teams around them? Yes, I'm probably going to vote for those players over Nick Arbuckle when it is all said and done, because I think the pure statistics are not the only thing that matters when you're considering the most outstanding player. But he deserves his flowers right now, because I thought Nick Arbuckle was done over a year ago. He came back. He impressed me in the Grey Cup. I thought that was a one-off. He did not look good the first couple weeks of the season. He has found his rhythm. He is playing at a high level right now, and he's doing it in a difficult circumstance for an organization that is struggling. He is the least of their problems. He is really the only thing holding them together and keeping them competitive. So he deserves our kudos.
With all due respect, he doesn't deserve to be in the MOP conversation. We're going to have multiple passers, if they stay healthy, go over the 5,000-yard mark this season. And I'm not saying what Nick Arbuckle has done isn't remarkable, because it is, considering the state of the Argos. But he can get one of Hodges' newfangled awards that he's probably going to put together at the end of the season. You can't even give him comeback player of the year.
So you're saying that the sixth-place person in the MOP race doesn't deserve to be in the contention? Sorry, I just wanted to clarify that. No, never mind.
This is a little different than that, but that's fair. That's a fair point. I'll take that jab. I think it's been great what he's done. He's shown that he can be a legitimate starting quarterback in this league after failing in multiple places. And, you know, there's multiple reasons for that. But kudos to Nick Arbuckle for what he's doing with the Argos. And the stats are really intriguing. You know, you look at Chad Kelly's season as Hodge laid out in 2023, and everybody was like, oh, yeah, he's an MLP for sure. Well, Nick Arbuckle is going to dwarf those numbers, and it's caused some fans to be like, well, okay, how much different would this team even be with Chad Kelly on the field? Like, Nick Arbuckle has played at a high level, and if anything for him, the most important part of it is going to be he's extended his pro career. Like, teams are going to look at this guy now as a legitimate backup who can come into games and win football games for you, if not a starting quarterback. I mean, just ask Cody Fajardo. Like, those starting quarterback seats can fill up pretty quick. But Nick Arbuckle has certainly made himself some money so far in 2025 on his next contract.
Yeah, the Argos are giving up 32 points a game. So, like, that is not the fault of Nick Arbuckle. There are times where you can blame a lack of complementary football, I think, for, you know, the struggles of a defense. If you're constantly, as an offense, turning the ball over, you know, field position, those types of things, or even allowing points offensively, right? If your quarterback throws a pick six every game, obviously some of those statistics with scoring and things like that are going to negatively affect your defense. That has not been the case here. The Toronto Argonauts can't run the football to save their lives. But other than that, I mean, offensively, they're solid because of what Nick Arbuckle has done. Obviously, DeMonte Coxey is a big part of that. I think he's the number two receiver in the league, second only to Kenny Lawler. And even then, I think it's a bit of a toss-up. But what Arbuckle did without Coxey, as JC, I think, astutely pointed out, pretty remarkable against a BC Lions defense that came in looking pretty darn good to that game and then got absolutely you-know-whatted, like absolutely crushed, decimated out there at BMO Field, left, I think, feeling embarrassed, as they should have. I don't see Arbuckle right now as a legitimate MOP candidate, but I do think that playing on a bad team should not preclude somebody from winning an award. I think it's something to take in consideration. Like, when we do our weekly three-down awards, offensive player of the week, defensive player of the week, what I will often consider, because I do take feedback from everybody, all of our contributors included, who cover all the different markets across the league, to me, like, how good the team did is like a tiebreaker, right? If you get two great defensive performances and one guy played on a team that gave up 4 points and won, and another guy plays on a team that gave up 100 points and lost, it's going to the 4-point winner, not the 100-point loser, right? And that, I think, is an appropriate thing to take into consideration. But I don't think it should be the end-all be-all, right? And we don't know what the numbers look like at the end of the year. This is just the pace Nick Arbuckle is on. It doesn't mean he's going to throw for 5,700 yards and 33 touchdowns. He might throw for even more, right? He might even outpace himself, or he might, you know, have very little success over the rest of the year. We don't know. We don't know the future. But I think Arbuckle deserves tremendous commendation. The other thing I'll say is Ryan Dinwiddie deserves tremendous commendation because I think he's made mistakes this year. Obviously, you know, defensively, I think that coaching staff progressed over the course of the offseason. I think that the personnel, not that this is Dinwiddie's fault, but the personnel regressed a lot from last season. But the fact that between McLeod Bethel-Thompson to Chad Kelly and now to Nick Arbuckle, consistently, Dinwiddie, since becoming the head coach and OC in Toronto, has consistently had quarterbacks who had either had limited success elsewhere or no previous success elsewhere in the CFL. He has consistently put them in positions to not just produce, but produce at a very high level, I think speaks tremendously to him. Because I think we've seen quarterbacks with tremendous tools on other teams never realize their potential, right? And the fact that Ryan Dinwiddie's like, oh, you've got limited physical tools and I'm putting you behind a bad offensive line and we can't run the ball to save our lives. Yeah, I can make you an MLP. Like, that is unbelievable. So I know that on the whole, his team has not performed well at all this year. And he's obviously in agreement with me on that because he's called out that very same team multiple times now publicly. But Ryan Dinwiddie deserves, I think, tremendous respect for what he's been able to do with his quarterbacks, not just this year, but throughout his tenure in Toronto. The guy is, I think, without a doubt at this point, the number one QB whisperer in the league. And I know he's talked about the NFL a little bit. It wouldn't surprise me if at some point an NFL team came along or a high-level college team came along and was like, hey, we need to get this guy working with our quarterbacks because clearly what he's been able to do in Canada is pretty remarkable.
It has been remarkable, especially for a guy who, like, let's not beat around the bush, has been a bit of a sacrificial lamb, right? Go out there behind that offensive line because we don't necessarily trust them to protect Chad Kelly's leg right now. And to do what Nick Arbuckle has done, it speaks volumes about him as a person and as a player. Don't think he's going to win the award at the end of the day, but when you talk about what he's been able to put up, the difference between him this year and Bo Levi Mitchell last year has less to do with their actual performance and more to do with the fact that other players around the league are playing better and have been healthier for longer. So we can't just outright dismiss him in this conversation. If a couple of guys get nicked up, I don't think it's outside the realm of the possibility. I don't think it's highly likely, but it is not outside the realm of the possibility that at the end of the year, Nick Arbuckle's numbers are going to be up in that top three MOP conversation.
I'll agree with one smart thing JC said. It's the fact that there are other players in the league playing at a similar, if not higher level, more consistently this season. Bo Levi Mitchell has had, you know, at least one down game that we saw in Saskatchewan. Trevor Harris has stubbed his toe against the Calgary Stampeders in the second matchup. The first one he threw for over 400 yards, and there was a game that he missed. People are going to make the argument for Vernon Adams Jr. I think Kenny Lawler, if he keeps going along at his current clip, is going to be in the conversation. So what Nick Arbuckle is doing is really good. And if it was a year like last year, to JC's point, with what Bo Levi Mitchell did in the East, I think that would be some legitimate talk. But there's going to have to be something happen to these other players for Nick Arbuckle to seriously get consideration.
The NFL's cutdown day is set for Tuesday as teams are required to get down to a 53-man active roster and then can formulate a 17-man practice roster once the initial cuts clear waivers. Could Taylor Elgersma make the Green Bay Packers? And what about some big-name former CFL players or Canadians who might be on the bubble?
All right, I'm going to focus on Mr. Elgersma because it is clear to me, and based on talking to some sources, that Elgersma has a really good chance to stick with the Green Bay Packers. Now, whether that's the 53-man active roster or the practice roster is to be seen. But I think it was very clear, anybody that knows even a little bit about football watching the preseason saw that Taylor Elgersma outplayed Sean Clifford, who has been in that offensive system for going into actually his third year now, like over 2 years since he was selected by the Packers in 2023, and that Elgersma seems to have more upside. Just from an improvisation standpoint, like Matt LaFleur gave him some praise for a couple of the plays that he improvised on in that game against Seattle and was able to keep the chains moving for the Packers, let alone throwing his first career preseason NFL touchdown pass. Some people might laugh, but that's a big deal. Like, this guy went from Wilfrid Laurier University to legitimately competing in the NFL. I don't think we can talk about that enough. That is a massive jump. Every step along the way, Taylor Elgersma has shown that it is something that he can fit into, assimilate to, and get better at. He's progressed in terms of how he's looked in the preseason. He earned more playing time in the preseason based on just that little bit that he played in the first preseason game with less than 3 minutes to go. That got him more playing time and actually got him into the game in the second preseason game earlier than Sean Clifford against the Colts. And then, you know, what I didn't understand was like Matt LaFleur going back and forth between these guys. I just don't think that you can properly evaluate a quarterback, and Matt LaFleur knows way more about that than I do, but by having these guys go in and out, like play them for a full quarter or more if you want them to be in the game. He said something after the game to the effect of, well, it keeps them both dialed into the game, but that's not how they're going to play in a real game if they ever had to go in. Mm-hmm. They're going to go in there and not be taken in and out every other series. Like, I didn't necessarily think that that was fair to either guy, Clifford or Elgersma. But again, Elgersma did his thing, moved the offense despite coming in and out of that game. So that's definitely a scenario to watch. You know, there are some other people around the NFL that will say, okay, well, there's going to be some other talented quarterbacks who do get waived and could potentially be picked up and added to the practice roster or the 53-man active roster. But I just look at the time invested by the Packers here. Signing Elgersma in May, him being in that offense, it seems like that means something to the Green Bay Packers. That's out on the flip side. Malik Willis was able to come in last year. I think it was a trade around this similar time, if memory serves me correct. Not really knowing the offense very well and being able to go 2-0 in the regular season while Jordan Love was sidelined. So to me, that's the major storyline to keep an eye on. There are some other guys that we'll get into, but Elgersma has certainly done enough, I think, to even earn a spot on the 53-man active roster if the Packers decided to keep three quarterbacks there. And that's a massive jump in pay going from the practice roster where you make over $200,000 US to the active roster where you're making, I think it's just under $800,000 US as a rookie.
I'll let JC talk about Theo Benedet since he was looking him up earlier. And I do think that he's a former U Sports player who could very well end up making the Bears roster. But I'll point to Ajoa Joe in Indianapolis, a guy who I know, I mean, the Riders don't necessarily need back. Their Canadian receiving depth has been sensational this year, but I'm sure fans in Riderville would love to have back. And then Curtis Rourke. I mean, Curtis Rourke coming off injury, I don't think is going to be in the mix to necessarily play this year for the San Francisco 49ers. But evidently, they liked him enough to use a seventh-round pick. So we'll have to wait and see how the numbers game plays out in San Fran. But obviously, a guy who they liked enough to draft, but isn't healthy, right, coming off that torn ACL, I think it's kind of impossible to predict what will happen there. So those are two names I'm watching for, but who knows what's going to happen. Cutdown day is Tuesday, as JC noted, and then PRs are set after that. So stay tuned to 3Down Nation. We'll have articles for all of these guys who are released or waived or PR'd across the NFL with CFL connections who of course have Canadian passports.
For me, it's all about the Hoggies. And the big story, as you mentioned, has been Theo Benedet this preseason, who went from essentially an afterthought with the Chicago Bears to working his way legitimately into the conversation to be their starting left tackle. And I don't necessarily know that he's won that conversation. We'll see as the week progresses. But I think he's earned his way onto the 53-man roster. He's been massively impressive throughout this entire preseason. He's gotten praise from head coach Ben Johnson. He has gotten praise from noted NFL analysts. Like Brian Baldinger just did a video on the kid. That's how well he has been playing in the preseason. And he's one of their highest graded offensive linemen. I believe their highest graded tackle through all that preseason action. Admittedly, mostly going up against number two units for the other team. But sometimes he's shut down legitimate starters. And I think he has put himself in that mix. He's going to start games at some point this year for the Chicago Bears if somebody gets nicked up. If not in week one as the bona fide starter. That's the player I saw coming out of the draft. The NFL saw a guy who was slightly undersized, who was coming from U Sports, who they weren't sure about. I saw a guy who could start at tackle in the NFL, and I think he has proven that in this preseason now that he's been healthy. So kudos to him. His former teammate, Giovanni Manu, of course, got the draft pick recognition from the Detroit Lions. They traded up to pick him last year. He's been inconsistent, let's say, in preseason for the Detroit Lions. It'll be interesting to see if he takes the next step and how much longer they're willing to invest in him. And the other guy I'll mention from that same draft class, Kyle Hergel. The New Orleans Saints have been decimated by injuries along the offensive line. He played a little bit last year. I'll be interested to see if he's in the mix for week one for the Saints because they've had a lot of injuries up front.
The best part about what Theo Benedet has been able to do with the Chicago Bears is that it's a new coaching staff.
Mm-hmm.
Usually it's out with the old, in with the new, a bunch of guys that are your dudes. But after Matt Eberflus was fired, Ben Johnson comes in. He has impressed that staff so much that he's put himself in line to possibly start for this team. And not even possibly start, but possibly start at left tackle. Like, that's unbelievable for one of, if not the most creative offensive mind in the NFL. It's part of the reason why Ben Johnson got the head coaching job in Chicago. He could potentially be protecting Benedet, that is, the blind side for Caleb Williams. Like, this is a remarkable story. Again, a U Sports athlete that could have been marketed better while he was at UBC by a bunch of different parties, but a guy who is now assimilated to the NFL level, went semi-viral on Hard Knocks. What was he called? The Canadian Eagle. The Canadian Eagle flying high with a freaking Speedo on doing his rookie skit. Like, that was some great stuff. He's just accepted everything and really done well in the majority of the facets there with the Chicago Bears. But to me, that's what stands out, fellas, is a new coaching staff has taken a liking to Benedet. We'd be remiss if we didn't mention Joe, because I think he's definitely a fan favorite in Rider Nation, potentially across the league, but definitely in Rider Nation. This guy achieves star status despite, you know, less than star statistics on the field during his rookie season. I'm not taking anything away from him, but the fact that Rider Nation just loved on him had a lot to do with his personality, and clearly some NFL teams were interested in him. He's been at Indianapolis Colts training camp, but, you know, I've heard that he struggled with press coverage. And he's a guy that could be better suited to the CFL using the waggle. Then he can get, you know, that big body running downhill at you. That's not to say that he's not going to potentially be in the mix. I think it would probably be practice roster at best for a Joe Ajoh based on what I've heard. But he's flashed his athleticism down there, has an intriguing catch radius, is a big body. He's a guy that, from what I was told, played mostly, if not all, receiver during training camp with the Colts, but you could look at him as potentially a tight end option as well. I know that's how some NFL teams were looking at him. So he's a name to keep an eye on as the waiver process plays out. I'm on that BC Kush this morning. Golly.
Four catches for 27 yards for Joe Ajoh in the preseason. Getting back to Benedet, wouldn't it be something if two different NFC teams had starting left tackles who were undrafted Canadians? Of course, Benedet would be one. The other is Alaric Jackson of the LA Rams. Yes, mostly raised in the US, but born in Windsor, Ontario, whereas Benedet was born and raised and coached 100% in Canada before going down to the States just last year as an undrafted player. Speaking of the esports ranks, JC, you released your Heck Crayton Trophy watch list featuring 15 players from across esports, with three conferences opening their regular seasons this weekend and Canada West set to kick off soon. Which player do you see as the number one most likely to win the award in 2025?
Well, I know who Dunk's going to talk about, and he definitely earned himself some accolades, so I won't go there. My number one player entering the season is Arnaud Desjardins from Laval. I think he's earned the right to be the leader entering the season, the betting odds favorite. This is a guy who was the RSEQ MVP last season, a two-time Vanier Cup winner, a reigning Vanier Cup winner, highly efficient, highly accurate, you know, didn't quite have the pop to his game to get to the CFL level, but certainly has the efficiency and the accuracy to be in that conversation, as we saw in the combine. Laval is going to still be a contender. They'll be in that Vanier Cup mix. When you've got a fifth-year quarterback of that status who has accomplished everything that he has in his career, not only do I expect him to put up numbers that will be worthy of being in the Heck Crichton conversation, he will also be tugging a little bit at the voter heartstrings at the end of it all when they say, well, this is our last time to vote for this guy. Sometimes they hand out a bit of a career award. I think with all those factors, Desjardins has to be the favorite at this stage.
That's fair. Arnaud Desjardins has been really good for Laval, but through his years there, there have been other players in U Sports that have been just a cut above him. That said, he's been really good. For my choice, I want to get out in front of this, okay? Because people are going to count the number of times I say Guelph or Griffins, but this is a completely unbiased take, okay? I think John and JC legitimately know this well, that I make anybody from Guelph earn it above and beyond anybody else before I praise them or talk about them in my reporting. So this has nothing to do, people are going to hate me even saying this, with the fact that I played at the University of Guelph, that I have an affinity for that city. That's where I was born and raised. Still call home to this day, back on the baseline. We have a family farm there, all the rest. This literally has nothing to do with any of that. From a completely unbiased standpoint, watching Tristan Abood throw, going into entering his third season, he has the potential to be, and I'm not saying this lightly, fellas, the next Canadian University quarterback who gets legitimate pro interest on both sides of the border, CFL and NFL. The name is Tristan Abood, University of Guelph quarterback. Look no further than how he performed in week one. The opening 30 minutes were not great. He held onto the football a little bit too long, but he was still 8 of 14, if the stats are right, for 90 yards. He came out in that second half against Laurier, who is returning 10 of 12 starters and has arguably the best secondary in the country, led by one of the most athletic dudes back there in Malik Cote, who you guys know real well from your CFL draft coverage. And he passed for 415 yards, completing 27 of 41 balls. Okay? Oh, by the way, he added 9 carries for 96 yards and 2 touchdowns, one of them a 40-yarder on the first drive of the second half in the third quarter to start a comeback. Well spotted. Laurier, 23 points in the opening half. Callum Wither came in, the Ohio University transfer, and did his thing, finding Ethan Jordan for a couple of majors to help pad that early lead. But Tristan Abood put that Griffins team on his back, along with some of his buddies, his roommate, Willem Arsenault. 5 catches for 120 yards in this game. He's from Calgary, spent time at Dave Dickinson's football camps out there while he was developing as a youngster. But if you are wanting to watch high-level quarterback play, there's going to be lots of it in U Sports this season, I believe, and we'll get into some of these other names like Arnaud Desjardins we just talked about. Tristan Abood might have the biggest upside of any Canadian University quarterback playing right now. For example, his head coach, and yes, he's biased, Mark Soria, said that he believes Abood is the best quarterback in the country. This is a guy that and was from Montreal, played Cégep football, went down to a prep school in the United States, has a chip on his shoulder because he believes that he could have, if the opportunity presented itself, led a big-time NCAA Division I program, and some people are going to laugh at that. But you go stand beside this guy, watch him throw the football, and then look at that tape from what he did to that Laurier defense in the second half, and yes, he needs to play more consistent football. This guy's outstanding. He definitely should be on the Hec Crichton watch list, but he should be on your own personal watch list because he is a high-level quarterback, along, as I said, with some of the other names that we're going to talk about, playing university football in this country. And I'm not going to sit here and say that, you know, all of these guys could be the next Taylor Elgersma, because that opportunity doesn't come along too often. But more teams in the NFL are going to start to look here because of what Taylor Elgersma has been able to do. Tristan DeBude could be one of those next guys, along with a handful of others.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Dunk. I think he's on the short list of people who can be even in that conversation. And there's lots of Hec Crichton worthy quarterbacks that aren't in that conversation. But Abud has enough of a frame. I think he's listed at 6'4". He carries it well. He has the arm strength. He has the poise. And the thing he has over Elgersma is he's more mobile, right? This guy can run a little bit. He can escape the pocket. He can create. That was the knock on Taylor throughout the draft process for all his other strengths. That's not an issue with Abud. And I think the best is yet to come from him.
And he's only in his third year. Yep. He's only in his third year. Like, he spent training camp with the Toronto Argonauts 1 year. This past spring, he spent training camp with Scott Milanovich, the quarterback whisperer, and Bo Levi Mitchell. Like, he's only in his third year. This guy has so much upside to be realized. Yes, he needs to realize it, but a very intriguing player.
And statistically, his career mirrors Taylor's almost perfectly. Right? A guy who comes in, starts a few games as a freshman, does some impressive things, has a second year where he's growing and building, and then that third year is supposed to be the breakout. If that first game is any indication, I think we could see something special.
I want to highlight two players who I think JC astutely pointed out. This can sometimes be a lifetime achievement award. Two guys who are back for their fifth years, Ethan Jordan, receiver in Laurier, and then Jackson Tuchinski, quarterback at Manitoba. I'm not sure Tuchinski has the receiving core to win this award, but I do expect him to be tremendously impactful along the ground again. The reason I would have Ethan Jordan above is because Raiden Thorne, who was the second receiver there in Laurier, is not back with the Golden Hawks this year, despite being eligible for a fifth season. So Ethan Jordan, to me, is going to get an even stronger share of those targets at Laurier. And it's hard to win this award as a receiver. Like, Kevin Mattel did it, but it doesn't happen very often. I think Ethan Jordan can put up the ridiculous eye-popping numbers required in order to win this award as a receiver. Two players who I don't think are going to win this award, but deserve a mention for their unbelievably insane performances. Game one, the Toronto Varsity Blues knocked off the Carleton Ravens 42-23 to open their season. I think this was the first time that Toronto and York, the two U Sports teams based in the GTA, won on the same day in almost 15 years, I think, JC. Is that accurate?
2011 is the stat that I saw.
Yeah, this is also the first time the York Lions are above 500 since 2016. So shout out to the York Lions. But Scott Barnett, who was with the Varsity Blues as a backup last year, got the start this game. He threw for 567 yards and four touchdowns in the win for Toronto. That is a new school record. And here's the wild thing. Of his 32 completions for, again, 567 yards, he only threw, or at least completed passes, to three different players. Chris Joseph led the way for the Varsity Blues with 18 catches for 257 yards and two touchdowns. That is a new school record for single game catches. It's also only one catch shy of the all-time U Sports single game record. So shout out to those two, Barnett and Joseph in Toronto, for a ridiculous start to the season. Those are some video game type numbers, and they're here putting them up in week one at the Carleton Ravens. Like, hopping on the bus, driving 5 hours, popping out and then just going absolutely ape, you know what, all over the Ravens. Just unbelievable performance from those two.
Hodge, you mentioned Ethan Jordan being able to potentially win this award. I think that's a great pick. In week one against Guelph, who has a veteran defense, he had 8 catches for 125 yards and 2 touchdowns, including a 71-yarder, where it looked like he pulled away from the Griffin secondary so easily. Yes, his receivers did a pretty good job blocking on that play too, but he was untouched down the sideline. And Callum Wither, the new starting quarterback for the Golden Hawks, seemed to look his way a lot. So I think you see that relationship has developed early in their time together, and it could lead to a massive season for Ethan Jordan, who, oh, by the way, last year became the first Golden Hawks player in the team's history to record 1,000 or more receiving yards in a single season. And for those that don't know, he did that in 8 regular season games. Like in Canadian university football, you play 8 regular season games, and he had over 1,000 yards potential to do it again this season. Of course, Ethan Jordan is an Ottawa Redblacks draft pick, so Ottawa fans keeping a close eye on him.
It's now time for JC's random neglister. And, you know, every week I try and stay true to the name. I try and pick a random player, an off-the-wall player, usually to address a specific need for a team. But sometimes something presents itself that is just too good not to talk about. And yesterday, as I was researching for this segment, the Ottawa Redblacks added Miami receiver Xavier Restrepo to their negotiation list. This guy is currently a UDFA with the Tennessee Titans, but it seems likely that he's going to be released. Only 3 catches for 26 yards in the preseason. He was really brought in as a favor to their quarterback, Cam Ward. But his college resume, guys, is absolutely something else. A consensus All-American in 2024 and left Miami as the Hurricanes' leading all-time receiving yardage leader with 2,844 yards. That's higher than Santana Moss. That's higher than Reggie Wayne. That's higher than Michael Irvin. That's higher than Andre Johnson. That is a program that has produced a lot of talent. And Restrepo has been at the very top. So why was he not a first-round NFL draft pick, a guy that's a lock onto one of those rosters? Well, he's a shade under 5'10". He's 209 pounds. And the reality is he ran a 4.86 40 at his pro day and at the NFL combine. That is atrociously bad, almost disqualifyingly bad. But the tape doesn't show it. He's quick. He's smart. He finds spots in zones. He has sharp route running ability. He's tough as nails. He'll get in there and block for you. Guys love this player, but they just can't justify it with that size and those athletic traits. For me, he's tailor-made to be a CFL slot back. He can come up here, prove his way back to the NFL. I think this is a smart and savvy addition for the Ottawa Redblacks on a player that is legitimately a marquee name for one of the biggest programs in college football.
It's also time for Hodge's Heritage Moment. Speaking of big-bodied slot backs who maybe didn't run super fast, but were very, very productive. On this day in 2017, Nick Lewis became the CFL's all-time receptions leader when he caught his 1,030th career pass. A longtime Stampeder, who was then in his 4th season with the Montreal Alouettes, retired at the end of the year, finishing his career with 1,051 catches for 13,778 yards and 68 touchdowns. The 3-time All-CFL selection was inducted into the Canadian Football Hall of Fame in 2021 and has since had coaching stints in BC and Calgary. So my next question has to be, JC, is Xavier Restrepo the next Nick Lewis?
Well, he's not quite as thick as Nick Lewis. I haven't checked.
No one's as thick as Nick Lewis.
How tall was Nick Lewis?
Nick wasn't about so five, thick when 10? He came into the league, though.
It's true. He was probably that about Restrepo's size when he came into the league. Yes.
The Geronimo era was when it was skinny Nick, and then he thickened out over the course of his career. I don't think it's a terrible comp, to be honest, because Nick Lewis was always a guy who was greater than his athletic ability or greater than his speed. And the other thing they have in common, Nick Lewis could lay a hell of a block. He took a lot of pride in that part of his game, Xavier Restrepo does the exact same thing. He gets his nose dirty. So perhaps there is a little bit of synergy there between our two weekly segments.
And for the record, Nick Lewis listed, depending on where you look, 5'10 or 5'11, so which means he was probably just a shade under 5'10, exactly like Xavier Restrepo. Though, Nick, if you're listening, please let us know exactly how tall you are. We would love to know.
It's also time for Justin Dunk's 3-minute drill, but it involves other people. I don't have my own segment, and I'm not really sure why, but we'll continue on.
Do you University- want Dunks, Justin Dunk's random update. Guelph Griffin? You just talk about a random Guelph Griffin. I love
Nobody
it.
Nobody would like that, but I was thinking about highlighting a Canadian quarterback at any level, potentially. So we'll see. True. It's in the works. I'm just joking around. I hate referring to myself in third person. That's just a personal thing. It's fine that you guys do it, but I just despise doing it myself. So sorry for that. Disagrees. I apologize profusely.
So does Hodge.
God. Okay, let's keep it moving. That's great. University of Varsity Blues. University of Toronto Varsity Blues receiver Chris Joseph caught 18 passes for 257 yards and a tug in his team's 42-23 win, as Hodge mentioned earlier. Is that reception total a single game U Sports record?
It's not. I forgot I talked about this already in the show. I was just so excited. So I'll use this as a chance to plug my weekly Around U Sports column, where I write about various performances from U Sports players. I break down all the games. It is one shy of the record. My column's out already for this week. And that record is held by Tyler. I'm trying to find my column here. Tyler Smith, I think, of Alberta, set in 2016.
Tyler Turner,
thank you. My column's not popping up here. We're having technical problems like Genius Sports. This is ridiculous.
We got to be better. Come on.
Give me 5 seconds. All right. I'm in the article. So it's the two receivers who have the record, and it's shared. They have both caught 19 passes. Were Andre Talbot, who went on to a very respectable CFL Ooh. Career. He did it with Laurier in 2000, and Tyler Henry of Alberta in 2016. So very close to tying the all-time U Sports record, just one shy for Chris.
Why is it not called John Hodges Around U Sports column?
I put my name in the mock draft because other people do mock drafts, and I want people to know which one is mine. No one else does Around U Sports, so I guess that's the answer.
With you.
It's a valid question, though. Miami Hurricanes defensive lineman Akeem Mesidor, an Ottawa native, was named the number one prospect on the fall edition of the CFL Scouting Bureau rankings. Do you think he'll ever play in the CFL?
No, I do not. Mesidor is a stud. He has been a stud dating back to his freshman season at West Virginia. He's a legitimate pass rusher at Miami. I'll be shocked if he's not an NFL draft pick. Certainly he's going to be on an NFL roster next year. I don't think the CFL is seeing him anytime soon. Brandon Banks told CHCH Bubba O'Neill he is officially retired. How will you remember Speedy B?
As a lightning-fast returner who could change games in a blink, and then for adding on that receiving ability, and of course that 2019 season where he won MOP and was just absolutely electric for the Ticats. Micah Awe was issued a max fine for a pair of hits in Week 11 against the Montreal Alouettes. Does he need to rein it in a little bit?
He does. I appreciated his explanation for the David Dallaire hit, and credit to JC for asking the question to Awe. And I get it to some extent, but at the end of the day, there's only one player in the CFL who's consistently being fined like this and who's consistently levying these types of high hits. I've never played middle linebacker at a high level, but I know there are 8 other starting middle linebackers who are able to prevent as many hits up high. So Micah Awe, I do think you've got to be at least a little better in this regard. It's a matter of player safety. It's up to everybody, right, to try to keep the players safe. Ottawa Redblacks defensive lineman Daniel Opoku was released from hospital on Saturday after being taken in an ambulance from Friday's matchup at TD Place Stadium. Is that good news?
It is great news that he appears to be all right. We don't exactly know what happened in that moment. It seemed like a rather innocuous hit, but it's always scary when a guy has to get clamped on the field and taken off on a spine board. I'm very thankful that Okpoko is okay. Got a chance to speak with him during the draft process. He came across as a great guy. He's got a bright future in front of him. I'm glad that we dodged a bullet here and it wasn't a lot worse. Canadian offensive lineman Sidi Sow was released by the New England Patriots and his CFL rights belong to the Saskatchewan Roughriders. Could we see him in green and white anytime soon?
I don't think so. You know, these types of guys, as you fellas well know, are going to wait it out. We'll see how the waiver process plays out for him, and he's going to want to see if there's any early season injuries, having been in the league already for 1 year. So, you know, I doubt it this season. I'm not saying it won't happen, but I would imagine he's going to wait out and exhaust his NFL options. The New York Jets released former CFL receiver Ontaria Pokey Wilson after he went catchless in the team's preseason finale. Could we see him back with the Bombers in 2025?
I do. Only three catches for Pokey in the NFL preseason, and this is a guy who's been in the NFL circuit before. He was an undrafted free agent with the Chargers in 2023, and he didn't even make it till final cutdown day. He was cut immediately after the preseason game as one of six players the Jets cut. So I do think there's a chance he'll be back. The Bombers maintain his rights. And I don't mean to sound hokey, but I think the Bombers would feel okey-dokey with Pokey. The RSCQ was renamed the Dunsmore Cup in honor of Hall of Fame coach.
That just made me trip, bro.
Well, look, they just lost Jarrett Stearns, possibly for the year, and Nick Debski is banged up. Like, this Winnipeg team desperately needs Saturday receiver.
I wasn't talking about Dalton that. I was talking about your rhyme time.
I know.
Okey-dokey, is that what it was?
I said, I want to feel hokey, but I think they'd be feeling okey-dokey with Pokey. Because
hopefully it's not they smoky. Need,
and hopefully it's not smoky. The RSCQ has renamed the Dunsmore Cup in honor of Hall of Fame coach Jacques Dussault. Is that an appropriate honor?
It is an appropriate honor for Dussault. He's the first Francophone coach in CFL history and also the first head coach in the history of the Montreal Carabin program. But I will say this, and I'm stealing this from Mo Khan on Twitter, who was the first to point this out. As much as I like to see Dussault honored, I wish they had waited a couple more years because we're not going to have Glenn Constantine as the head coach at Laval for forever. Nobody has won the Dunsmore more than him. His records will never be broken. It would feel appropriate if when he stepped away, they named the trophy after him. By making this move now, that's probably never going to happen. I would have liked to see that honor bestowed on somebody after his retirement. The Rough Riders removed former first-round NFL draft pick Trey Lance from their negotiation list. Does that mean we'll never see him in the CFL?
Yes. It was a fun off-season story, but this guy has earned over $36 million. USD and is set to earn at least a couple million more. It seems like he's going to make the 53-man active roster there with the Los Angeles Chargers. But honestly, it was definitely intriguing to talk about. And if he hadn't caught on somewhere, maybe it piqued his interest. But homeboy, if he invests his money, doesn't even do it in Bitcoin, can just sit back, relax, collect the percentage points. I can't even think of the right term right now because I'm on this BC Kush. But anyways, he doesn't have to play football any longer if he doesn't want to. Yes, interest. God, where's my head today? It's up in the clouds, boy. Sorry. No, we will not see Trey Lance, but it was great for Three Down Nation and some other outlets. Smoke the clouds. So Trey Lance will be doing when his NFL career is done.
Smoke the Clouds is JC's second single. The first, of course, still being Smoke the Truth. For Justin Duck, JC Abbott, I'm John Hodge. I have found my Around U Sports column. It was not a technical problem. It was 100% user error, so that is my fault. We will see you next week for an even longer podcast. It's apparently our podcast lasts 10 hours, though.
Hodge, yeah, make sure you tell the people, though. Like, subscribe, comment.
Yeah,
leave us a 5-star rating. Hit that subscribe button on YouTube to make sure this thing gets served up to you right away.
Look up our addresses.
Don't follow us on the street. That sounds terrifying.
I'd like someone to show up outside JC's house with a bear costume, and he'll think that bear from the cabin followed him back into the city.
That would be terrible.
John Hodge likes that idea.
Buying a car in Carvana was so easy. I was able to finance it through them.
Whoa, wait. You mean finance?
Yeah, finance. Got pre-qualified for a Carvana auto loan, entered my terms, and shopped from thousands of great car options all within my budget.
That's cool that financing through Carvana was so easy.
Financed. Done. And I get to pick up my car from their Carvana vending machine tomorrow.
Financed.
Right, that's what I said.
You can spend time trying to pronounce financing, or you can actually finance and buy your car today on
Carvana.
Financing subject to credit approval. Additional terms and conditions may apply.